My name's Jason. I'm an alcoholic. And, boy, Billy wasn't kidding. You guys just get right into it down here, huh? My sobriety date is December 21st of 1995. My home group is the Midtown Group. And I'm, you know, thanks, Billy, for asking me to come out. I'm always happy to participate in my own sobriety, to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, especially to be asked to speak. I don't mind, you know, telling my story at all. It's my favorite story. I'm my favorite speaker. Sometimes listen to my talks on tape and try to gain inspiration from them. You know, see where I can improve. And no, I'm just kidding, but sort of. But I am grateful to be asked to do anything for AA. And anything I do for Alcoholics Anonymous is a privilege, and I recognize that. And I'm going to try to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And, you know, I guess a good place to start is what I was like before I took a drink. And I can tell you that my whole life, as far back as I can remember, I suffered from what it refers to in the doctor's opinion as being restless, irritable, and discontent. And I, you know, as a kid, I didn't know that. I didn't have that language. I didn't use that terminology. The terminology that I had was that I was weird, you know, or different. And I picked that up from what other kids called me, you know. Like, that kid is different, you know. And so, from an early age, there was a separation that took place, you know, and that was me and everybody else. And it's not to say that I never had any friends. I was never a popular kid. I was always kind of a nerdy kid or a weird kid. Not nerdy because I was good in school, because I wasn't at all. But I never ran with the in crowd. I was always kind of an outsider, and I never quite made my way into the in crowd. I don't think that has anything to do with my alcoholism, but the indicator is that it affected me in such a way that I thought there's something wrong with me. You know, I always felt that nobody pointed that out to me. You know, I knew that was true. And the more I focused on that, because I was always a self-centered kid, the more it became apparent to everyone else that something had to be done. So before I ever picked up a drink, my parents started dealing with the problem. You know, what's wrong with Jason? What's the problem with Jason? You know, and so from an early age, I mean, I was in the fourth grade getting sent to therapists, you know, working stuff out in art therapy, and probably around the same time I was put on medications for attention deficit disorder. A lot of people were at that time, you know, being put on Ritalin, and I was on that stuff. And then later I got put on medications for depression, and I used to fake like I had headaches so that I could sleep in the nurse's office. And so I got put on this headache medication, and I never actually had headaches. I just lied about it, but I was constantly on some kind of pills. The irony is from 18 to present day, I've had headaches like 3 days a week, so it's kind of like God, like, you know, paying me back, I guess. But I've just always been a troublemaker. You know, I got kicked out of CCD when I was 10 years old for throwing the book at the CCD teacher, and I come from a great home. A middle class to upper middle class family in the middle of suburbia, a new suburban neighborhood in Ellicott City, Maryland, is where I grew up. And I have great parents. They got divorced when I was real young, but I don't have like an absentee dad. I mean, I have a great dad who's always been present in my life, always tried to be present in my life. And I had an older brother and a couple of older stepbrothers that I looked up to a lot. And then later I had a younger brother and sister that came along. You know, but, you know, I had everything going for me as a kid, except for this deep sense of inferiority and insecurity and constantly under tension and feeling like I didn't quite fit in and I didn't belong. And as much as my parents would try to point me in the right direction, I mean, they signed me up for sports teams and I never cooperated. They signed me up for, you know, I got sent to, you know, counselors and therapists and you know, religious education and taking to church on Sundays, and you know, I was sent to tutors as a kid because I had a hard time in school, not because I'm not intelligent. I always thought I was smarter than all my teachers, to tell you the truth, but I never wanted to do anything, and so I got the talks about my potential and how much I could do if I only applied myself, you know. I mean, and I was sent to the principal's offices and the vice principal's offices, you know. I mean, I lived in a principal's office, you know, all before I ever took a drink. And like I said, I had an older brother and an older couple of stepbrothers, and, you know, when they started drinking, I soon after followed suit. Before they started drinking, they started stealing. And so we became those kids in the neighborhood where if something was broken, you know, like if you came outside and your car window was broken, it was probably one of us. You know, if your hood ornament was missing, sorry, you know, it was probably one of us. You know, and there were other kids in the neighborhood that weren't doing that stuff, good kids. Going to school, playing soccer, stuff like that. But we didn't have anything to do with them. You know, we were troublemakers. And we used to go to the mall and just steal as much as we could. I used to go to the mall by where I lived with a book bag and just fill it up with stuff. Just walk in. And I'm talking 10, 11, 12 years old. 10-year-old kid. I'd walk into a store and just look right at a clerk and put something in my bag and walk out, you know. And I wasn't stealing because I wanted for anything, because as a kid I never did. I was stealing because I couldn't stand the way I felt, and for 5 seconds after I walked out of that door, there was a kind of excitement about it, you know. It meant something to me. And so when my older brother and stepbrothers got involved in that stuff, I got involved in. And I remember one night we were out, cause no good, at, you know, 11:30 or midnight, you know. One of my stepbrothers probably had a baseball bat. Another one may have been carrying a knife. We never stabbed anybody or beat anybody up with bats. We just liked that kind of stuff. You know, we were, you know, running the suburbs back then. And so we went up to this Giant, where I grew up, the grocery store. I saw this Mercedes-Benz hood ornament. My stepbrothers were like, don't do that. It's a dumb idea. We're in the middle of a parking lot. So I, you know, wanted to prove to them that I could take it, so I started yanking this thing off, and I couldn't get it off, and the woman comes out of the grocery store and happened to come out when I was attacking her car on her hood, and I'm yanking on this thing, and she's screaming at me, and she's a big lady, so she's charging at me with that cart, going, go, you know what I mean, the cart's, you know, jumping the tracks, and she's running towards me, and I see her and start running, and figured I could outrun her, but I didn't know about her 18-year-old kid who was already had a head start on us, and this kid starts running after us, and my stepbrother Ryan was on crutches at the time, so he's crutching as fast as he can, and my stepbrother Michael's running, and my brother Dave's running, and they're booking ahead of me, and I don't know if this is alcoholic thinking, but I had this thought, this guy's not going to stop chasing you until he catches you. So I just stopped running. I was like, screw it. You know what I mean? So I just stopped, and he tackled me and took me down and, you know, roughed me up a little bit and brought me back to his mom and called the cops. And I got arrested, and that was the only time I've ever been arrested in my life, actually. It's pretty pathetic, but I tell that story because I do have a criminal record. I was 12 years old and was issued community service. And so I was a troublemaker before I started drinking. And alcohol... When a kid like me starts drinking, you know, some people, they get better on the outside. You hear people tell their story and say how, you know, a kind of alcohol kind of evened them out for a little while. And some people, you know, go straight to hell. I was one of the ones that went straight to hell. You know, that's the bottom line. I started drinking when I was 13 or 14. I really started drinking when I was about 14 years old. You'd think by me talking about how much I looked up to my older brother and stepbrothers and how they were kind of, you know, bad kids that they would be alcoholics. The truth is, as far as I know, none of them are, as much as we all like to party. You might think that I started drinking with them, that they turned me on to it, but they didn't. I started drinking with my friends, you know, and with this one guy who was 23 years old and crazy enough to buy alcohol for a bunch of, you know, underage kids. I never really drank with my brother or stepbrothers, maybe a couple of times. But, you know, even in my own family, and I don't really know how to explain this other than to just kind of say it, but even within my own family, I always felt like I was running to catch up. I always felt separate from. It wasn't like a social thing that was going on at school. It was like in my family, in school, in sports, in any kind of situation you'd put me in, I would feel like the guy sitting in the back row in the corner, you know. And I believe that to be that illness that it talks about that's within my spirit. That really is my alcoholism, you know. A lot of people are neurotics. A lot of kids grow up feeling lonely and not being able to make friends. But I think what makes me an alcoholic more than anything else, more than any of the trouble I cause or the people I hurt or the fact that my drinking was totally crazy and out of control for the period of time that I did drink, what makes me an alcoholic is that when I take a drink, it makes that go away, you know. And the first time I got drunk, I can't tell you much about the experience or the situation. I mean, a lot of people know every second of what happened when they took their first drink. My story's not like that. But I can tell you that sense of separation between me and the rest of the world was wiped away, you know. And all of a sudden I could come out and play. And I was one among many. And I felt comfortable, and I felt happy, and I felt good. I felt a sense of freedom. At the time, I wouldn't have said that. I couldn't say much of anything, you know. And a lot of people talk about, they felt like 10 feet tall and bulletproof. And I didn't necessarily get that sense. What I got the sense was, before I drank, I always felt, you know, and I hung out with losers. You know what I mean? Like, no offense to them. I was hanging out with them. I was in good company, you know. But the guys I wasn't hanging out with the football team. You know, I was hanging out with the same kids that couldn't make friends with anybody else, too. And, you know, at the time, we would listen to, like, Black Flag or Metallica and wear denim jackets and, you know, combat boots. Those kind of kids. You know, those kind of guys. That's who I hung out with, you know. But when I drank, even amongst them, I felt kind of inferior. When I started drinking, I felt just like everybody else. I felt, you know, great. I couldn't believe that the booze that we bought only cost 99 cents. I felt like this is the investment of a lifetime. You know what I mean? Because I bought a quart of King Cobra malt liquor, which is not top shelf alcohol. I don't know if any of you have actually had that stuff, but it's pretty awful. I quickly upgraded to Mickey's, which was a little step up. I think that was about $1.16 a quart. And so that's what I drank. And I drank... I never drank in a bar. I've never had a legal drink in my life. I drank under the bridge behind the liquor store that we bought from, for the most part, or in the woods. I quickly stopped drinking that King Cobra and Mickey's after probably a couple of months, maybe a little more than that, and moved up to bourbon. I used to drink this stuff called Evan Williams bourbon. It looked like Jack Daniels, but wasn't Jack Daniels. You know, it was like a knockoff, you know, and... a little higher proof, a little cheaper, and that's what I love to drink. And I love drinking bourbon because, one, even at 14, I wasn't a man by any standards, but when I drank bourbon, I kind of felt like one. You know what I mean? And I felt like this is a man's drink. I didn't know anything about alcohol, but I really felt like this is a man's drink, you know? And the other reason was because I drank outdoors all seasons. You know what I mean? We had a 7-degree day. You know, a couple of nights ago, I'd have been out drinking in that weather, you know, outside when I was growing up. And I did many times, you know. So I'd freeze my butt off out there, and bourbon will warm you up a little bit, you know. And I loved it, you know. And for a while, my drinking was fun, harmless. I didn't associate my drinking or my drunk escapades with any kind of craving. It wasn't like, you know, I got a couple of drinks in me and then all of a sudden turned into Frankenstein and started, like, pillaging the town for as much booze as I could get my hands on. I drank to get drunk, you know, and never associated it with that craving that we hear so much about, you know. So in AA, when I'd hear people talk about that, I'd be like, well, when did that happen in my story, you know? And I really had to look at it, you know. And I had to look at those times when I would get drunk and I would start feeling good, and then I would just keep on drinking. You know, and keep on drinking. And I don't have a story where I drank a half a gallon or a gallon of vodka, but there are many times that I drank past my tolerance, that I drank and overshot the mark, that I wound up laying on some bed with the room spinning, you know, praying to God for this to end, and that, you know, and then, of course, going out and drinking like that shortly thereafter, you know. And so when I look back on my story, I can see that my drinking was out of control, you know, and And I didn't pay a lot of severe consequences for a while, you know. I mean, I had a great time out there, you know. What happens is if alcohol does for you what alcohol does for me, sooner or later it's gonna take over. And that's what happened to me in a short period of time. Anything else that had been interesting in my life was no longer interesting. I was a born loser. I always got terrible grades in school, so it's not like my grades declined. They may have gone down a little bit, but I mean, I'm a guy who was put in special education in the fourth grade and basically was in some level of, you know, special ed or learning disabled classes from the fourth grade until the day I graduated high school. And, you know, so it's not like I was a success and then all of a sudden drinking started to ruin that. It was more like I was a loser and alcohol made that okay. You know, a friend of mine says alcohol gave me the satisfaction of a job well done without having to do a damn thing. And I can't think of anything more attractive than that for a loser like me. And that's why I loved it, you know. I never particularly excelled in anything, but when I drank, I didn't care, you know. And so my drinking was a lot of fun. Sometimes I'd end up passing out somewhere when I was out drinking with my friends, and I'd wake up, you know, still half drunk and have to walk home a mile or two. Sometimes I'd go out drinking and I'd do something that I would later be ashamed of, and I'd kind of come to the next morning and I'd think, you can never tell anybody about that, about what happened last night, you know. And I have those stories. But for the most part, I didn't really pay a lot of consequences. Now, the entire time my drinking was making my family crazy. They didn't know it was my drinking. They thought of it more as, you know, where'd my $20 go? Or, you know, where's Jason? Where's he at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know? But they didn't associate necessarily with drinking. They just knew that I was a troubled kid, that I was up to no good, that I was out with my friends, probably doing stuff that I shouldn't be doing. Shortly after I started drinking, I started doing drugs. I loved those just the same way that I loved alcohol. And I know this is an AA meeting, so I'm not going to go on like a long binge about all the drugs I did and all the terrible things I did. But what I will say is that I had the same attitude towards those that I had towards booze, which is that even if I didn't know what it was, I would take it and I would probably like it. You know, and most of the time I did. Not everything I tried out there gave me the sense of relief that alcohol brought me. Not everything I tried out there brought me the same sense of freedom that I got from alcohol, but it didn't stop me from trying. Didn't even stop me from trying two or three times sometimes, you know, just to make sure. But, you know, within a couple of years, my drinking turned from something that I loved to do that was fun, became the only thing that I knew how to do to have fun, and then soon after, alcohol and drugs became the only thing that I knew how to do at all, ever. And at one time, I would steal $5 from my mom to go buy a bottle of bourbon and sneak out with my buddies and sneak back in, stumble home drunk, and hopefully not get caught, you know, before I get woken up to go to Saturday school. I was always in Saturday school detention, you know what I mean, for getting in trouble in school. And so I'd have to stumble into Saturday school still drunk from the night before. And I had those kind of consequences. Within a couple of years, though, it was more like from stealing $5 to stealing $20 to stealing $50 to $100, $150. And it went from sneaking out for a couple hours in the middle of the night to get drunk and get that sense of ease and comfort to sneaking out every weekend, pretty much, or sneaking out on Tuesday or Wednesday. And then I started to get caught, you know. Maybe some kids would get caught and kind of straighten up and not do that anymore. But what happens to me is I get worse, you know. I go from sneaking out to saying, F you, I'm leaving, and flicking my mom off or cussing her out or telling her that she's a bad mom and waiting for her to turn her back. And now it's the point where I'm 16 years old and my mom's hiding her purse. Every time she comes into the house, she's locking it up somewhere. And then it's some kind of cat and mouse, like, what does it take to get into my mom's purse? You know, where is she hiding the money? You know, and I tear the house apart. And I remember one time I was stone cold sober. You know how we get, you know, just sober, just shaking and crazy and neurotic. And all I can think about is getting out and going downtown and meeting up with my friends and partying. And I remember tearing the house apart, tearing the study apart, the dining room, looking for where she hid the money. And I found it. I found $400. And I took $200 of it. Then I thought to myself, not such a bad guy. I mean, I only took $200, you know. I left her $200, you know, and I ran out of the house and I partied for a couple of days with my friends and came back a couple of days later, you know, of course not calling, you know, hungry, strung out, crazy, you know, just totally self-centered, you know. And when I would get out there and I'd get that relief and party with my friends, I'd go to these clubs in downtown Baltimore. They opened up at 10 o'clock at night. They shut down at 5 o'clock in the morning. And then there was always an after-hours party. And then we always went to someone else's house after that. And then I'd realize that I hadn't eaten in a day or day and a half. And I'd call my parents and come crawling home. Sometimes they open the door and they let me sleep it off. Sometimes they open the door and throw a quarter at me. Say, go call your dad. You don't live here anymore. And my dad at this point, someone who'd always been in my life. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, when I was growing up, when I was 7, 8 years old, taught me how to play baseball, you know, used to play catch with me in the yard, that kind of dad. I got that kind of dad, you know. He worked a night shift at Johns Hopkins ER, and he'd get off work at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I used to have to walk to school when I was in the 8th grade. And my old man would get off of work after working a 12-hour night shift in the ER in downtown Baltimore and come and sit out in front of my house on rainy days so that he could drive me to Hardee's and buy me breakfast and then take me to school, you know, that kind of dad. I mean, the kind of person who lived to show up for his kids, you know, and yet at this point I hadn't really talked to him in a couple of years. I mean, I talked to him every couple of weeks, but it would be as short conversation as possible. And he didn't really see me during this period of time. I had given up on seeing him on weekends a long time ago because I couldn't drink around him. You know, I mean, he was tough, but my mom I could get over on, you know, I had a stepfather that I had to contend with, and so we'd have those nights where I might get thrown up against the wall and choked, or I might get, you know, pushed over or screamed at. I deserved a lot worse than what I got, but I was willing to put up with that to get to go out there and drink and do what I like to do, you know. And so within a couple of years, I was at a position where that sense of isolation and feeling apart from had grown. You know, whereas at one time I thought my drinking put me in the middle of life, now I live with this sense of isolation and hope and total hopelessness. You know, I remember towards the end of my drinking, I came out of this club in downtown Baltimore on the corner of Russell and Bayard, right by Raven Stadium. If anybody's ever been there, right by where that stadium is where this club was that I used to go to, And I can remember it's, you know, coming out, and it's like you're in this dark, dank warehouse club until 5 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden, you know, those doors open up, and it's like sunlight, you know, and I'm walking out, and it's like, it's sunlight, but it's not really, like, bright yet, and I walked into this gas station to get breakfast, which at that time in my life probably consisted of, like, a Pepsi or a Mountain Dew, you know, and I got a soda. And went up and paid for it. And somebody came into this gas station in a suit and tie, dressed like I'm dressed now, right? And got a cup of coffee and a newspaper, paid for their gas. And I just remember looking at this guy thinking, you're never going to be there. You know, you're never going to have that kind of life. The kind of life of a normal person who has a vehicle and a place to go in the morning to work, you know. I mean, I had nothing but drinking and getting high. That was my life. And I knew that sense of being different that I'd always had my whole life was the cause. But I never called it alcoholism. I had no idea what it was, you know. And that wasn't some kind of, like, jarring experience that sent me running to rehab or AA or anything like that. That was just the way it was. It wasn't like a realization. It was like I deeply knew that, you know, that I was not like other people and that I never would be. And I felt terribly guilty about taking from my mom all the time, you know. Sometimes I'd call her and tell her about it. I'd be in one of these clubs and I'd start getting ripped. And then, of course, once I got that relief, I'd start to feel bad. You know, I mean, it wasn't like it was a party anymore. All of a sudden, it's like every time I get that sense of relief, it brings with it this 10,000 pounds of guilt And so I stumble into one of these clubs' bathrooms, and somebody had, you know, scrolled someone's calling card number on the wall, you know, who knows whose it was, but I used it, you know, and called home and just waited for my stepfather to pick up and said, "I'm okay, don't worry about me," and I'd hang up, you know what I mean? And what must that feel like for my family to get those calls at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, not knowing where I was? They figured out where I was eventually. One time I was out partying at one of these clubs, and I had just started to feel good, and I was dancing on the dance floor, which I love to do, and I looked up and I saw the security guard with a flashlight, and I was like, "That's weird. The security guard's in the middle of the dance floor of this club." And then I looked behind him, and it was my stepfather in pajamas, and he dragged me out by my ear, you know, at like 2 o'clock in the morning. I was, you know, and I was just so embarrassed and humiliated, and felt, you know, of course, terribly guilty. And so that's what I was like, you know. I was a pain in the ass. I was never a criminal or a mastermind or anything like that. I was just kind of like a nuisance to anyone in my life, you know. And the closer you were to me, the worse you got hurt. You know, even my brother, who, like I said, loved to drink, loved to smoke a little pot. You know, he loved to have a good time. I mean, my brother was a bartender, has been a bartender most of my life, you know. But his drinking never caused the kind of damage that I caused in just a couple of years. You know, he had this sense of duty to his family, this sense of responsibility. And I saw my family as a group of people to use for money, for connections, for shelter. And that's pretty much it, you know. Because I'm so insanely self-centered that I'm basically all I can think of. After a couple of years of living like this, I ended up having, I had a breakdown, you know, just in front of my family. I just lost my composure. You know, a set of circumstances came up, and, you know, my dad came over to the house, and, you know, I just remember him smacking me in the face and wrestling me to the ground and saying, "Look what you're doing to our family. What are you doing to this family?" You know, and I remember just feeling so guilty and shaken up by that experience. Because my dad's kind of mild-mannered, you know, very quiet guy, very calm, peaceful, nice. He's a nice person. He's a good person, you know. And to see that kind of emotion from him shocked the hell out of me. So I you know, went inside and I talked to my mom and I said, you know, "I've got a problem and I need to go into treatment," you know. And they were like, "No problem." You know, there was no like, "Are you sure you have a problem? Or you think you can beat this on your own?" They were like, you know, on the phone. And the next day I thought maybe I'd been a little too severe, but it was too late. All the wheels were already in motion, and I ended up going to this place called Oakview Treatment Center. It's not open anymore. And it was close to my house, just a few miles away from my house was this rehab, and they sent me in there, and I went in with every intention of staying sober. I wanted to stay sober, you know. I saw that I couldn't stay sober on my own because I'd have these times where I would make these attempts, and then a week later I would just find myself in the car with my buddies going downtown. You know what I mean? How did that happen again? You know, I'd make resolution after resolution. It didn't mean anything. At the time it would mean something, but I never changed anything. And so I thought, people go to rehab to get sober, and that's what I'll do. And so I went to rehab, and I, you know, went in there, and I wanted to stay sober, and you know, I sat in therapy all day, and I participated, you know, somewhat, but I really kind of felt like my act of willingness was agreeing to go. And then by the time I was there, I kind of felt like I'd done everyone else a favor. Even though I'm dying on the inside, I mean, I'm coming home every day thinking about killing myself. But I think I'm really doing everyone in my family a favor by coming to this treatment center. And then I'm thinking that they're not cooperating with the program the way that they should, you know, and like because they have a problem too, you know. And then I remember having this conversation with my mom. I had only been in rehab like 3 days, and I'm convincing her that it's going to be okay for me to go back home and hang out with my old buddies. And she's saying, "I don't think that's a part of the program that they're teaching you there," and I just got frustrated with her and self-righteously said, you know, "I'm the one who put myself in here," and blah, blah, blah. But really, what was happening was I was convincing myself that it was okay to take a drink, but I didn't know that, you know. Because alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Part of me believed that I was going to leave that place, hang out with my old friends, and stay sober, you know. But part of me knew part of me intuited that maybe I just couldn't do it. Maybe I didn't have what it takes. And so after 7 days, I convinced all the kids that I needed to leave that place to go buy a pack of cigarettes, and that if they gave me money, I'd buy them cigarettes too, because I was on an adolescent ward and we weren't allowed to smoke. And I thought, I just want to smoke a cigarette. That's all I want. And so I did. I got all these little kids in rehab to give me their money, and they did. And I went out and I bought a pack of cigarettes. And then the first thing I did was I walked over to the payphone and I started calling my friends until I found someone that could pick me up. You know. And then we went over to my friend's house, and everyone there was getting loaded. I got loaded. And the minute I felt that relief, I felt what had been coming with it for the last year, year and a half. And that was that sense of, you can't even stay sober a week. You can't even make it a week in rehab. You're in rehab. And even my friend said to me, like, didn't you put yourself in rehab? And I said, yeah. And my friend Chris said, but now you're here with us. I said, yeah. He was like, you're dumb, dude. And I was just like, you're here with me. Shut up. You know what I mean? And but so, of course, once everyone got messed up, you know, we're all laying out. And I just started thinking, you know, I can't even make it 1 week. And then I started to panic. This sense of anxiety came over me. Like you're not going to beat this, you know. And I started to feel that hopelessness that we talk about. And I had felt that for a long time. But for some reason, this night, it really hit me. You can't stay sober. You know, you can't make it. You know, and of course, what are you going to do? And I mean, you know, my whole life, I've just prided myself on my potential and kind of figured that eventually I'm going to graduate high school. Eventually I'm going to go to college. Eventually I'll get a girlfriend and maybe a driver's license. You know, I mean, I was 17. I didn't have a driver's license then. I didn't have a driver's license until I was 2 years sober. You know, but I had any kind of hurdle of responsibility that had ever been placed in front of me where other kids were doing certain things, I just tripped right over it, you know. And I really saw that about my life, that basically my life consisted of drinking and getting high and nothing else, you know. And it just kind of became more and more clear over the last year that I was out there that you're not just going to get it together. You know, you're not gonna pull yourself up by your bootstraps one day and start doing what everyone else is doing, because I'd always convinced myself that I could, that I had that ability, because I knew I was kind of a smart kid, and it just occurred to me, you're gonna die like this, you know, and it wasn't like I didn't have the thought you're gonna die like this, I felt it, you know, I felt like this is the direction that my life is going in, and there's no changing that, you know, and so that. Then this sense of panic hit in, and I started crying and begging my friends to take me back to rehab. So the only thing that I associated with getting sober was rehab, was a treatment center that I was in. I didn't know anything about AA at all. And so I started begging my friends to take me back, and I was killing their buzz, so of course they did, you know, and they took me back, and I was banging on the same doors of the treatment center that I'd broken out of 6 hours later, asking them to take me in, you know. Because I wanted to be sober, but I couldn't, you know. And they took me in long enough to call my dad, and he picked me up. And by that time, it was probably 1:30 in the morning, and it was October, late October. It was raining, and it was cold, you know. And I just remember my old man coming out in that weather and picking me up, and I just remember seeing that look in his face, you know, that I had seen many times before in him and in my mom and in my stepfather and in my brother, that look of fear and disgust and worry and, you know, basically the, what are we going to do with you now, you know. I mean, this is a guy that probably, you know, the day I was born didn't see himself picking me up from rehab when I was 17, you know, after breaking out. He probably saw me graduating high school one day and, you know, doing well. I probably saw those things for myself. But here's where we were, you know. Started out in school, and I was in special ed, and I was on all these medications. Then I was failing out of special ed. Then I started drinking and doing drugs. And now I'm picking up my kid from rehab at 1:30 in the morning. You know, what a winner. And the whole ride home, it was probably 15 or 20 minutes, I just felt like such a piece of crap. And I just kept saying, things are going to change, Dad. This is the last time you're going to have to do this, Dad. Because he had picked me up from many places before. Picked me up from some alley in downtown Baltimore. Picked me up from places I'd left my, you know, I'd just gotten left, you know. And I just remember thinking and saying, this isn't going to happen anymore, Dad. This is the last time you're going to have to do this. And it was. It was. That was enough for me. You know. Something happened to me that night, and I don't know what it was, but I am so grateful. And I think it's the grace of a higher power. I finally felt bad enough to try AA. I finally felt done enough to try AA. And so the next day I came, I walked a 5-minute walk away from my dad's house to the AA clubhouse that I'd grown up practically next to, you know, and asked for help. And a couple of months later, I ended up taking a drink. I don't talk about that a lot, but that night was in October. And my sobriety date, like I said, is December 21st. And I can't tell you why I took a drink a couple of months later. I mean, I really feel as if I was surrendered at that time. All I can say is that I didn't have enough of a respect for alcohol. When people talked about relapsing, drinking again after a period of time, I always imagined that meaning you go out and you get ripped. But I didn't understand that if you take one drink, that that's drinking again. And so that's what I did. A couple of months later, I was dating this girl who was a non-alcoholic, who I had met from someone that I had gone to meetings with. And I go over to this girl's house, and the girl that I was going to meetings with was drinking a beer. And so I just thought, well, I guess you can have a damn beer. And so I took a sip out of my girlfriend at the time's drink, and that was it. That was actually my last drink. But shortly after coming to AA, my brother had known this guy that was in the program, and I got hooked up with him. And this was someone that I had drank with a couple times, but I didn't know real well. But I knew that he was like me. I knew that we were into the same thing, which was partying and drinking and pretty much nothing else. But now he had 2 years sober. And so I started running around to meetings with this guy, and I got acquainted with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Learned how to play spades, you know, played spades probably 5 nights a week for my first 2 years of sobriety, and you know, loved it. I had a great time, and it was so important for me to have a safe person to turn to when I was new, because I didn't know anybody in the meetings. And I knew, and I would go to meetings, and I knew intuitively that I belonged here. I mean, I knew that in my heart, that I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd go to meetings, and I felt like people were speaking my language, that language of the heart that we have, you know. And I understood that, but at the same time, I still felt tortured by the same feelings of insecurity and inferiority that I'd always had. And so it was important for me to get to know some people in the beginning. And that's what my first sponsor really did for me. He introduced me to the people that he was friends with, and they quickly became my friends. And I felt like there were people that I could talk to, that I felt safe around. And it wasn't like we were burying each other's souls. We were basically just hanging out at the diner after meetings, you know. But I loved that, and I needed that. But I wasn't really exposed to the program much over my first couple of months. And then eventually, after a few months, I got a sponsor that would walk me through the steps, because I'd hear other people talking about the steps, and I felt like I'd always kind of thought of myself as an overachiever. Now, I was failing out of special ed at this point in my life, but I thought, you know, I can do this, you know. And so I got a sponsor that would take me through the steps, because I wanted to be a part of, and not much else, you know. I will say that the fourth and fifth step were immediately interesting to me. From when I first came to AA, the first time I saw those steps, I thought they would be important. And the reason was because I had just a mountain of garbage, of things that I did, things that I thought about myself, that, you know, just a ton of wreckage and shameful secrets that I thought made me a terrible person. And I was dying to get that stuff out to another person. And so that's another reason that I initially started out on the steps, was I really wanted to get that fourth and fifth step done. I wasn't afraid of writing it. It had been running around in my mind for years, everything that I put on that paper. And so it wasn't like I was avoiding something. I mean, I was tortured by my thoughts and by the things I'd done and the people that I'd hurt. And so I started working through the steps, and I worked through the steps to the best of my ability within my first year, you know. And that was that I took the first three steps in a very rudimentary way with a sponsor. I definitely recognized my powerlessness. I started to pray. I wrote a fourth and fifth step. I completely flew past six and seven. I had no idea what the hell they were talking about, but I guess you could say I read those chapters in the book, you know, or those chapters, those paragraphs in the book that talk about six and seven. And I made most of the really important formal amends, direct amends, within my first year. And then after that, I went into the military. And for the next couple of years, my sobriety consisted of, you know, making things better with my family, which is good, is important, going to lots of meetings, I talked to a sponsor. But I never, in my first 5 years, I didn't really get grounded in a group. I had no appreciation for what it meant to be a member of a group, you know, and I completely missed the boat on helping others. I mean, I would help others because I felt like there's some sort of status associated with sponsoring people, you know, and so I would sponsor people, but mostly it had to do with looking good. And I mean, and most of my life had to do with looking good, you know. Even my relationship with my family, I was concerned. I was very happy that they weren't worried about me anymore, you know. And they weren't, you know. My mom was no longer hiding her purse. I had keys to everybody's house and stuff like that. But really, I came to AA so I could hear myself talk, you know. I mean, I wasn't much of a listener, you know. And I mean, it wouldn't matter what meeting I was in. My hand would go right up in any discussion meeting. You know what I mean? And sometimes they'd like, you know, they just wouldn't call me. I was like, you know, come on, don't you guys want to hear what I have to say? And so my understanding of the steps had to do with being able to share about a step in a meeting. You know, so if we were in a meeting on the sixth step, I would have like a sixth step talk. You know what I mean? And so that when I got called on, which I would persistently raise my hand to get called on, I would have something to say, you know. And I would tweak it based on what people said to me. Sometimes people come up to me after a meeting and be like, I really appreciated what you had to say on the sixth step. You have a good understanding of what this thing is all about. And I would think, hang on to what you just shared. And I would just share that for the next 3 or 4 years of my life, you know. And same thing every time, you know, because I needed that sense of approval, you know. And I was ego tripping, you know. And so by the time I got out of the military, I had just under 5 years sober, and I moved to the D.C. area, and I started going to Midtown. You know, first time I went to Midtown, Clancy spoke. And I didn't go for a few weeks. Second time I went to Midtown, this guy, Hugh McGee Jr. spoke. He had 35 years. I thought, this is a damn good meeting. Every time I go, someone's got 45 years, 35 years. I didn't know they had a guest speaker once a month. You know, and that I had only gone about once a month for a few months. But so I started coming back. And there's an energy in that room and in that meeting that, I mean, it's palatable if any of you have ever been there. I mean, you can't walk into that meeting and not be greeted by 30 people. And it doesn't end when you hit the door. A lot of meetings have greeters set up. But in my group, we make you feel welcome, whether you like it or not. You know, you will be welcomed. And it's not a plastic handshake at the door. We're really interested in helping the newcomer feel a part of and feel like they're important, you know. And newcomers that come to my home group know that we're concerned with their sobriety, that we want them to stay sober and that we're in their corner and willing to do whatever we can to help them. And I needed that, you know. At 5 years sober, I needed that. A close friend of mine at this time in my life, when I had 5 years, committed suicide. Untreated alcoholism. He was sober. We got sober together. And that event kind of sent ripples throughout my little circle of buddies that I had made up over the last couple of years. And people just kind of moved to different areas of the country. And not as a result of that, just as a result of not having a group to hold us together. And so coming to this group that was so welcoming and inviting, and it was very, very comforting at that time in my life. And not only was it comforting, but it was intimidating. And all of a sudden I felt like I had to establish myself here. And I heard my sponsor speak one night, Jack, who I'm not sure if you guys have had him out, but I know a few of you know him. And And at this time, I was seeing a therapist because I could not get out of this suicidal depression I was in. I mean, here I had just gotten out of the military, tripled my salary, bought everything that I thought was going to make me happy, and none of it did. And so I started seeing this therapist that my sponsor at the time had recommended. On my third visit, he told me I'd have to be on some kind of antidepressant medication for the rest of my life. And I'm sure there are people that need those kinds of medications. But my sponsor that I have today talked that night after I got that diagnosis, or shortly after I got that diagnosis, and he delivered to me the message that I needed to hear on that night, which was, some people might need to take medications, but I'm a person who suffers from alcoholism, and to fight my alcoholism, all I've needed was AA. And it penetrated. I knew that he, because my sponsor and I have a very similar story. Very similar. And I knew that he had what I had, but that it wasn't kicking his butt like it was kicking my butt. So after the meeting, I went up to him and I asked him for his number. And I never actually asked him to sponsor me. I don't think. I have no memory of asking him to sponsor me. But it was clear that I was asking him for help, and he began to help me. For a little while, he was real nice. And then it just seemed like something happened, you know. And I remember one day I called him up to tell him I got these tickets to a concert, and it was in a bar, but that it was okay because I wasn't going there to drink. And he said, "You probably should have called me before you got the tickets." And I just started to stutter. I'd never been talked to like that before in AA. I mean, I'm a guy who loves to hear myself talk and not get talked at. Mind you. And before I could retort, he just hung up on me. And then he went out of town for 3 days and didn't answer my phone calls. And I was like, geez, you know, like, this is, you know, what happened here? You know, I thought we were friends. And, you know, where's the love? And the next 6 months of my life are what I like to call AA boot camp hell. You know, I mean, and that's what I received. Some people might call it tough love. I mean, if you're in therapy, maybe you get tough love. I just had a tough sponsor, you know, and there was no, I don't know that he loved me at all. In fact, recently he told me that I was just intensely unbearable to sponsor. I was hard to sponsor for years, and the reason was because he said, I couldn't just ignore you like some pigeon that wasn't interested, because you were genuinely interested in the program. But at the same time, you were such a know-it-all, I couldn't stand to take your phone calls. So every time I called him, he was tortured. He just told me this a couple of months ago. And hopefully things have changed, you know, and that's why he confided that in me. But at the time, man, I mean, I'd call him and tell him about how good I was doing, and he'd say, you help a newcomer for 5 minutes and then pat yourself on the back for a half hour and then wonder why you're miserable. Click, you know what I mean? Or one time we were hanging out and he was screaming at me and cussing at me and telling me what he thought of me and my self-centeredness. And I told him that I was very sensitive and that lately I've been so depressed that I was thinking of killing myself. And he said, I think you should do it. He said, you know, you're the most self-centered person I know, and all you think about is yourself, and you have no connections with other human beings. I'd want to kill myself if I were you, and you have my blessing, you know. And I thought, where's the love, you know? And you know, but the truth is, I didn't need his love because I love myself so much, you know. And what I needed was someone that could put a chink in the armor that my ego had built up, not in my drinking, but in my sobriety, where the light of reason could shine through, you know, just like it says in 12:12. And Jack was the answer to my prayers, you know, and that's what he gave me. And eventually, Jack and I did a fourth and fifth step, and I read my fourth step to Jack and found myself in a place where he knew everything about me. And we were driving home from the beach when I finished the fourth step. I read 3 hours of it on the way back, and about an hour and a half on the way up, and about an hour and a half on the way back. And after disclosing basically everything that had ever happened in my life, and all the resentments I had, and all the judgments that I had towards him and his sponsor, and so on and so forth, I found myself in a place where we sat for about an hour, listened to a little music. The book says to sit for an hour, and that's what we did. And there was a shift that took place where I realized that my sponsor wasn't getting some pleasure out of being mean to me, but that he was helping me. And it, at the same moment that I felt that sense of being helped by my sponsor, I realized that all these people in this big, warm group that I had feared and judged, that they were in my corner as well. You know, and I would love to say that the last 8 years I've been in the Midtown group has just been wonderful since then. You know, but that's not the truth. The truth is when my sponsor hurts my feelings, it still hurts my feelings. My first reaction 8 years later is very similar to what it was when I had such a hard time talking to him, when I first got him for a sponsor. My pride swells up. I get egotistical. The first thing I think is, he doesn't have all the facts. How can I re-explain this in such a way so that he'll understand that I'm right? Or how can I, you know, sugarcoat this? And then sometimes I'll do things in my life and think, there's really no way to sugarcoat this to your sponsor. You're just going to have to tell him and like hold the phone a few inches from your ear. And he doesn't yell. He's not a yeller. He's not a terrible man. He tells me the truth. Sometimes he says it in a way where I feel comforted, but still like my inventory is being taken. Sometimes he says it in a way that lets me know that he's not kidding around. And but I still have that relationship with a sponsor who knows me and tells me the truth, and I still have resistance to that relationship. And the reason I think it's important to say that is because that really kicked up about 3 weeks ago. I had a talk, I read a long inventory to him, and I had a long talk with him where I did not do most of the talking, you know, and it was really painful. And for a couple of weeks, I had probably a week or week and a half, I had a pretty vicious resentment towards my sponsor, you know. And I had to open up the book, and I had to do exactly what it says in the book to treat that resentment. And I surrendered it to the God of my understanding, to the best of my ability. And as far as I know today, it's gone, you know. So I'm still an arrogant person. I still have all the defects that I came in here with when I was 17 years old. I'm 30 now, and I've still got them. You know, I've got some new ones that I didn't have back then, just that life has given me. But I have a sponsor who keeps me small enough to stay here, and I have a group that I feel a part of and at home in, and I have a God of my understanding that I turn to when those things aren't sufficient, you know. And recently, in my sobriety, it's become more and more apparent to me how much I need God, you know. I'm not a religious person at all. But I will say that having a strong home group and a good sponsor and all the support that I've had has, I don't know if it's come from the group or what, but I've kind of developed the attitude like, to rely on the principles is enough. To rely on my group and my sponsor is enough. You know, and I know that God works through those things. But recently it's become very apparent to me how I'm still spiritually an infant. You know, how little faith I have in God concerning my own life. How much I take the wheel and try to steer. And how fearfully I live my life as a result of that kind of attitude. And I know that there's so much more available to me in my sobriety, so much more in my life that's available to me if I live differently than the way that I've grown up in AA. And so I'm just in a place where I'm investigating more. What does it mean to have faith? What does it mean to really trust? And I'm not saying that to stand up here and sound good and a year from now you guys will have me back and I'll talk about having a conversion experience. Nothing like that. I know that I have a long way to go. You know, and I know that that if I look at the old timers that I respect, there's something that people have that I want, and I think that's worth investigating. So Thank you for having me out, and thanks for listening.